Accession number 28495, Reel 8.
I will use Reel 8.
Right.
The dogfighting that you were doing with the camera guns, was that amongst yourselves? Would you just go...
Oh, no, this was official. No, we wouldn't...
Would it be with an instructor?
Probably not, no. Self. Camera work, solo. Probably almost all solo, I think, when we're doing camera work. Or we did some camera work there with an instructor. But obviously not a lot. Because by this time, we're knowing how to fly the aeroplane, we could do this work, and the camera would soon tell the instructor whether we're doing it properly or not. And of course, it was a case of allowing for deflection. But I think with the camera, you didn't have to allow for the deflection, as long as you could pick up the target and keep with it. This is a longer section of the course. We're doing longer hours here.
But again, a constant repetition of the same stuff, is it really?
That's right, to a large extent, yes. And you see, we're now doing a longer flight here, night flying, 2.5 hours. It's quite a long time. In which case, I was the pilot, and Highlands was the observer. On another occasion, Seban was the pilot, I was the observer, 2.5 hours as a passenger, which counted as the navigator, you see.
And would you be checked all the way through this course as you were doing it by an instructor? Would there be sections where somebody would check
you? You would tend to be checked towards the end of a session. But if the instructor had the slightest doubt about you, he would ask somebody to check you for a second opinion. And this is what happened to those people who failed the course. And it nearly always happened very early on. They would quickly find out those who were not going to make pilots, and it was too expensive to carry on with doubtful material. Again, this pattern still is continuing to an amazing amount of the same sort of procedures.
Was there an emphasis on night flying towards the end of the course?
I wouldn't say there was an emphasis on it, but we certainly did more. Because it's more, this is the night flying column, you see. We now go up to 11.5 hours a night as a pilot, a dual, and 9.5 solo.
Because I'm just wondering, at that stage, obviously you hadn't been selected for what type of pilot you would be.
No.
There was more emphasis at that stage in the war than the RAF for night operations, weren't there, than perhaps earlier in the war?
The decision as to what you would go on would not be made until you got back home, and that would depend entirely on where you were needed. You wouldn't have much say in the matter. But we're still clocking up a respectable number of flying hours at night time, and 12, 14 hasn't changed much there for some reason or other, but now we're probably just done about enough. And here we come on to a special long-distance cross-country where we land in different airfields and stay overnight. And on this flight, you take turns in being the pilot or the observer, navigator. This was straightforward from... 15th, Jones with my instructor. I was his observer, so that was just nearly 2.5 hours flying from Mesa Falcon Field to El Paso. El Paso is virtually on the border. I'll come back to that in a moment. El Paso to Marfa I'm the pilot here, and that went smoothly. Here, I'm the pilot again. Flight Lieutenant Faulkner was one of our RAF instructors on navigation, and he learned to fly in Arizona, but he was a navigator essentially. And I took off from Marfa, and he took off and he gave me a course to steer. That was his navigation. And then he watched the ground for a few minutes and he gave me an alteration. He'd watched the angle of the drift, you see, and he gave me a correction and he'd finished his navigation. And he settled back and he closed his eyes. I could watch him through the mirror. I'd set the normal speed, but the aircraft was flying slowly. I thought, this is strange. It's not doing the speed it should be doing. I thought, better tell him. So I told him, I said, I can't understand it, but I said, I'm using normal power, but the aircraft is flying about 30 miles an hour slower than it should. Oh, I said, let's try it on. It'll pick up. And he went to sleep again. And warm afternoon, I idly put my hand down, and there's a lever there which shouldn't have been there. It was the hydraulic lever, pressed for hydraulic power. Every other aircraft on the field had it wired down. I don't know why this wasn't wired down. I'd missed it. So I looked at that, and I looked at the indicators. The wheels were still down. So I thought, I've got a problem, because when you retract the undercarriage, it comes up with a clunk. So I pressed the lever to get a bit of power. I operated the retract, brought them up, milked them up slowly and slowly and slowly, and he closed with the slightest clunk. He didn't hear it. And once it had settled down, I spoke to him again. I said, I'm not sure it was quite what happened, but he seems to be flying all right now. I didn't let on. But there was an incident. Yes. Where we were on this flight. It might have been here, south to Marfa. And he's doing the navigation. And he'd given me the course to steer, which I steered. And after a while, I knew it wasn't right. So he's busy doing the paperwork, because you're going to be checked on that as well. So I said, look, Alf, this course is not right. I need a correction. And he wasn't sure, because it was all desert. But below us was a big telescope housing in an observatory, the only thing human thing for miles. So I put it into a gentle turn and said, look down there, Alf, yes, there's a pinpoint. I said, I'll just circle this gently until you give me the course. Well, after a while I thought, we're going to run out of petrol or we're going to miss our dinner. So in the end I said, I'm sorry, I'm going to set course, which I did. Meanwhile, he's still doing the paperwork. It was a great relief to me when we did hit Marfa dead on the nail, and we're only a few minutes adrift from the others. But an even more interesting story, at El Paso, it's on virtually on the border between Mexico and the States, and the compass correction there, I checked it on the map not long ago for our pilots association, it was about 14 degrees. Now, our two heroes left El Paso, and before they knew where they were, they were in Mexico. So when they started map reading, they didn't recognise a thing. And they flew on and on until it was running out of time, running out of petrol. They saw a landing strip, and they landed and were promptly put in prison. They were in Mexico. The news got to the mayor of the town, and he hauled them out of prison, and they became honoured guests for the night. And of course, they telephoned the airfield with this story. And their orders were to stay put, not to fly, because, you see, Mexico is neutral. This is a warplane. And they sent out an engineering party to take off the wings and bring the airplane back. Now, in America, going over into Mexico meant another medal. There's no shortage of volunteers. And our two heroes came back. But in this newsletter, there was a lot of discussion about this, and I put forward the simple explanation that they'd applied the magnetic correction the wrong way, which they had, which explained that particular incident. This was our... It's a kind of end-of-term long-distance cross-country, this. It's the most interesting one. And spending the night with an American Air Force base was most interesting, too.
So is it almost like, this is it, we'll see now if you can apply all your elements of flying and knowledge that you've got to doing this long-distance?
That's right,
and,
yes.
And you will navigate each other across there? And
exactly, yes. Mm. And... So now we do something else, beam flying. This is using the radio for beams. There are lots of radio signalling system around the area, and now the Harvard being equipped with radio, we could go out and pick up a beam and learn how to fly along it. It's giving out a different signal whether you're on to the left or the right. So you then would learn how to home onto a radio beacon. That was fairly straightforward. And now we have final check ride there. There's still a little bit more flying to do, but this is now a formality, really. There's not much more to be said about this.
So at the point of the final check... Mm. What's your status at that point?
You're virtually through. And you see the final check, it was 50 minutes. It's a fairly thorough check of your flying ability. Your navigational ability has already been tested on the in the classroom and in the air. And you can pretty well say it's now a matter of bringing your hours up to those required to complete the... system, which was 55 dual, 55 solo, 8 and 12 respectively at night time. That completed the course. I think, let's see.
And what happened with the completion of the course? At that stage, what is your status then? Are you still, are you awarded wings at that stage?
Yes. In the last week or so, in addition to doing the flying, you'll be doing ground subjects. And all through the course, we'll be doing half-day ground subjects, half-day flying, and switching it over. So sometimes you'll be doing ground in the morning, and flying in the afternoon, and then reverse the next week. Flying in the morning was best because it wasn't too hot. The afternoon, the thermals, and it's bumpy. Also, the food was absolutely out of this world, it really was. And if you enjoyed the full breakfast, you were glad not to go flying because it was an enormous breakfast. Lunch was substantial, so was dinner. I couldn't fault it.
So you are awarded your... Is there a ceremony at this stage?
Yes. There is a graduation ceremony. There is a statement of the fact that you've passed. And there was a list posted of the marks awarded for ground subjects. And these were airmanship, armaments, meteorology, navigation, signals. And my assessment was... where are we now? My average percentage was 81. and I was fourth on the course. Two and three were Americans. We expected that. The man who was top, friend of mine, I suggest no favouritism at all, he was good. But he came from an RAF family. His father was a senior RAF officer. He may have been attached to, he may have been in America in an administration position, but he was certainly good. So I wasn't grumbling at fourth, but when I was looking at this list, the senior civilian ground instructor came past and had a chat. He said, "I thought you were going to be first, Albert." I said, "Well, I'm not grumbling." I said, I never do as well in exams as I seem to do in the class. I think I'm too fiddling and fussy. And there was an interesting incident in the final navigation exam. All the maps were spread out on the tables and all the gear ready for us. And we looked at this, we were in the Northern Hemisphere, we'd done all our work in the Northern Hemisphere, and we looked at this final navigational exam, it was in the Southern Hemisphere. Oh, there was a riot. Nobody believed it. They were turning the map upside down, they were walking around looking at this. And there was no apology for this, of course. They said we might have to operate in the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, if you look at the map, the chances of that were nil. It's so that Australia, even the Japs, didn't get much further. The other problem was that the calculator, which is like a circular slide rule, there were two forms of conventional calibration, and normally we'd be working on one calibration. Now, because we're short of these calculators, they put out the two types. So one was right and one was wrong. So the instructor apologised and said, "Don't worry, we'll make the corrections." I just hope they did. Anyway, we did it, and I got 75%.
So you passed all your exams, you received your wings. What was the move like from there? Where did you go to from there?
Well, there was a big parade toward the wings, of course. And, of course, there was a list of those who'd been commissioned and those who were sergeant pilots. Now, this place, Falcon Field, was, if you like, the plum place in the whole of the training system. So anybody who was anybody would almost certainly get there. We had a Lord Strathcarron. He was with my instructor. Somebody like Anstruther. And a lot of people with university squadron background and that kind of background, or volunteer reserve background. So they were all the people who were going to get the commissions. And this Falcon Field Association, the most populous topic that went on for a long time was the question of commissioning. And it was repeatedly said that commissions were not given according to merit, but according to who you were, which was fairly true, I think, at that time, anyway.
What happened to yourself? Were you
commissioned? I got sergeant pilot. I didn't mind. It made it easier to go into Fleet Air Arm.
So when you left the field, where did you go to next? Did you travel back to the UK?
Yes. Well, straight away, they sent us back to Moncton. Now, we're leaving in February, January. We left in February, so we're going up to Canada in the winter. So as we're approaching the northwest of America through Boston, it was getting snow building up, and the train was diverted a few times because of problems there, and the river's frozen. And we got to Moncton, everything was frozen, the river was frozen, everything was frozen, and we had to be issued with earmuffs. And we could only put parade in hangars. And there were problems about accommodating us. And I have a few notes in my diary which said that frequently we'd be marched out of camp and left and locked out just to get rid of us. And it was cold out there. Anyway, we survived. And eventually we were told we would come back to England on the Andes, where I met one or two friends who'd gone as navigators. The Andes was a shallow draft boat, ship, very fast, and it's designed to go up the Amazon, which is why it's fairly shallow, so it rolled. And it rolled. There were times when I thought it would never come back. We came over in the winter, and of course it was very rough indeed. But it made a quick crossing, and we got to England, and we were astonished how green it was. It was really green, beautiful. And of course, while I was in America and Canada, I started buying things. And when it was time for me to come off the Andes, I had a double-sized kit bag which I'd bought. I had two ordinary-sized kit bags. I had my pack and a fishing rod and some of the other things. I couldn't carry it. One of my friends, who was not so greedy, he carried one of the kit bags off for me, otherwise I had to leave it. And we went straight up to Harrogate just for a day or two, and then sent on leave for a short time.
And when you came back from leave, is that when you went to Elmdon?
Yes, not immediately. Let's have a look. It was the next posting. Elmdon, May the 11th to the 24th. Flying Tiger Moths. Elmdon was Manchester's airport.
Birmingham.
I do that sometimes, dyslexia. We were usually flying with a navigator in the Tiger Moth with us, just to get accustomed to local conditions. Good training, because the weather was different from Arizona, and the airfield was undergoing major construction, so we only had a short amount to play with. I remember one flight when we were doing a simple cross-country route, so I was flying under navigator instructions, and on the first leg I looked at the weather and I told the navigator, I said, I don't like the look of this weather, I think I'm going to turn back, start adjusting your log kind of thing. We're flying into a thunderstorm, and looking at the ground, the wind had changed 90 degrees, and from a gentle wind it was a strong wind, so I turned and came back, landed safely just before the thunderstorm arrived. Soon after that, based in the same airport, we went to a small satellite airfield, which was just a big grass field, to do some night flying landings. And on one of the nights, going round the circuit, I could feel I was being lifted up. And I throttled back until the engine was idling, and I was still gaining height like a glider. I had to push the nose down. I had to practically dive it round the circuit. And when I turned on and lined up with the flare pots, I could see that the smoke was blowing across a strong 90 degree. It's a bit tricky doing a crosswind landing, which we've been trained to do, fortunately. So I got down and stayed down, and the rest did the same. So the night flying was cut short, but we still got our egg and bacon breakfast. That was the tradition. That was all done. We did the same kind of thing at Cambridge in August, but
I think in between, didn't you do a 5-week course with the army?
That's right, you've got it more complete there. This is only for flying stations.
What was this about then?
This is in June, Whitley Bay. It was a course of the kind that an infantry army soldier would take. Again, it was another way of holding people in a useful capacity. And we were converted into army dress, army fatigue dress, and army hobnail boots and that kind of thing. We started learning to do cross countries with pack, use of the rifle. a lot of eating out of field kitchens in the country. And then we were trained on weapons, revolver, rifle, stun gun, throwing grenades.
Is this essentially at this stage because there's a bottleneck, though, in the
I think it's
training?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that we weren't immediately required. Now, the interesting thing is that most of the people who were commissioned, many of them would go on to operations or operational training. And we lost quite a few like that because they went on to operations early. And not necessarily all the best of the, in terms of flying abilities, see. There was one rather interesting coincidence. Can you see that? Dick Medhurst, Richard Medhurst, he graduated at Falcon Field as a pilot officer, and at the age of 19 he was the second pilot on a Dakota dropping supplies at Arnhem, and the pilot, Flight Lieutenant Lord, went round a second time with the aircraft on fire to drop the supplies at Arnhem, and the plane exploded and crashed. So poor old Medhurst died with a man earning the VC. I was lucky I did it in a different aeroplane. So not a coincidence, that. And here's a letter which says how, because of his competence, they were about to give him his own aircraft because he was a good pilot, as he was. And he was the man who came top in the exams at Falcon Field.
So at that stage, the rest of you who weren't commissioned at that stage, you were in essence in holding units, passing time, doing
that's right. Yes, that explains this Whitley Bay business, where we spent most of June at Whitley Bay.
I think you also did. You did another course as well, didn't you, at that time?
Yes. Yes. Incidentally, we were at Whitley Bay when we were told about D-Day. What was that, June 6th? Yeah, that's where we learned about it. Now, from Whitley Bay, we went back to Padgate, Warrington. Now, this was home to me. Home was 8 miles that way. Fishing was 8 miles that way. They had nothing for us to do, so they more or less said, well, if you can offer some outdoor activity, sporting activity, you're on. So I said, I like cycling. I like swimming and rowing. He said, okay, cycle. So I got the bike out. So I lived at home and commuted into work. And then I could cycle the other way and do some rowing at my fishing place. I may happen to do a bit of fishing as well. I was quite happy to win the war this way. Of course, it was too good to last, because we'd only been there a couple of weeks when a man with World War One pilot and World War One medals and pilot's wings, he got us into the hangar and he virtually dressed as a gentleman, so we would do anything for him. And he said, we want you to do a secret job. He said, it's so secret I can't tell you what it is or where it is, but it's important. So my friends were bored stiff, they volunteered, and of course I went with them. And we went to Gaines Hall, St Neots. Have you heard of it? Where they were, you've come across this. And we were packing canisters with military supplies to be dropped behind the lines to the French resistance. When we got there, we were all put into one Nissen hut, which was like the Black Hole at Calcutta. So we immediately complained, and they put up a huge marquee, and 6 of us fresh air fiends went into the marquee. The rest stayed in the slums. It was so warm, they didn't bother to put a ground sheet down on grass and 6 beds. It was beautiful living in there. When we went to work, we were locked into the working space. And the job was these canisters. There's a photograph over there.
Just a second.